Welcome and hello. This is Joseph G. with the Rum Radio and rumradio.org, the most comprehensive 12-step sponsorship in the known and the unknown universe. I guess the unknown universe would be around Uranus.
Well,
I would like
Stephen Hawking's talking about that. There's some new theories of dark energy and the force that occupies the space in between the electrons and the protons in the nucleus of each atom. It's very fascinating. They say the same thing exists in space between the galaxies and so forth. Well, that is officially the unknown universe now.
Well, I like to think of the... I'm most concerned about the empty space between my ears most of the time. I'd like
all
to
right.
acknowledge WNAH, Hoyt Carter, and Tony the Horse, who affords us the opportunity to broadcast live to their listening audience in Nashville, parts of Kentucky, and Arkansas as a public service presentation. We'd also like to acknowledge RecoveryToday.net magazine, one of the finer recovery journals that affords us some print space from time to time. I'd greatly like to introduce my co-host, Harold B., a family intervention specialist. He does a fine work with troubled families, and I personally believe the families are the basic unit of our society, and as the family goes, so does the country. Harold?
Hello, everybody. Thank you, Joseph. It's my privilege and honor to work with families and individuals. I work with children. A lot of the work I do includes suicide prevention and drug counseling. I consider it a calling from God, and it's work that it's the kind of thing that chooses you. You don't choose it. So it was a long time in coming. I'm a father of four and grandfather of nine, and really believe in the family and enjoy my work. Tonight I'm here as a recovering person, realizing that intensive work with another alcoholic is the most successful thing. That succeeds when other things don't. And so we're here to talk about that and inspire people to give that a try. And I want to take a moment to mention that the website that supports this radio program is called rumradio.org. It's a nonprofit attempt at getting more information out there about working with other people. Joseph is the one who has designed it and repairs it and improves it at his own expense. It doesn't bring in money. It costs money to present, and he is the support for that financially and the inspiration. So I want to appreciate him for doing that. And this program, I owe my life to this program, and I want to do what I can to give back, and this is an excellent way to do that. The main thing is learning enough about the steps in the program by working it ourselves so that we can help other people work it and in that way stay sober. So, Joseph, let's begin.
Thank you, Harold. Today is Mother's Day. And in that idea, no language can express the power and beauty and heroism and majesty of a mother's love. It shrinks not where man cowers and grows stronger where man faints and overwastes of our worldly fortune, sends the radiance of our quellness, fidelity like a star. A mother is a person who, seeing there's only four pieces of pie for five people, promptly announces she never did care for pie. to Never Jordan. Today we're going to be announcing, or we're going to be talking about, this is 12 and 12, Dr. Bob times 5,000. In other words, it's taking somebody through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, the 12 steps has expanded to other 12-step programs, but they're 12-step programs because of the 12 steps initiated by Bill W., one of our co-founders of AA. And Dr. Bob, our other co-founder, who was a doctor, a surgeon, and a proctologist, he was the quiet guy. He was. I wrote a post that was called, "If Bill was the sail, Dr. Bob was the anchor." Dr. Bob had sponsored 5,000 men, really quite an amazing task, considering they went through pretty quick back then, and you'd have to if you went through 5,000. So on that idea, we brought back some of these concepts, a back-to-basics approach. Now, you don't have to take someone through in 24 hours, although sometimes it might not be a bad idea. You could take longer, take several weeks, but at least the information is there and available if you so desire it. And I think that's really the key with 12-step program, is having the information available. Step one, a simple truth stands on its own. Out of the 12 steps, step one is the only step that is required to be of perfection. All the other steps are ideals. We do the best we can, and we strive for that ideal of perfection, knowing that we'll never really reach it. None of us are saints, but we believe in progress, not perfection. So this is a progress, except for step one. I just had a sponsee, you know him, Kelly. You know Kelly, don't you, Harold?
Yes.
Okay. Well, he was doing really good. We just started step four. It's as far furthest he'd ever gone. We just began the understanding of step four. And things were good. He was excited. I could see a light in his eye. He's been a chronic relapser. Reminds me of Ebby, who was Bill W.'s sponsor about 75 years ago, chronic. And I saw that light in his eye, and I got a call yesterday, and he went really quick. There was a confrontation with his wife, and for some reason, and he took responsibility, he thought a beer would be a good idea. And his wife got upset and followed him to the community pool and poured a beer over his head in the front of the community.
She thought that would be a good idea.
I guess. Took his cell phone.
This is a family illness, and everyone has their particular part of the illness.
So he went out and spent money on booze and alcohol, and he was going to go on a tear. And, of course, after I picked him up, we ended up going to a meeting. He's very tremendous amount of self-pity is going on, and we had a nice little chat, and he wanted to know, why did I stop this? He says, I was doing so good. Things were starting to open up for me. In a very short period of time, he said, my life, I finally had serenity for almost a whole week. He says, I've never experienced that before, and I just went out and had the beer. He said it was sabotage. Big Book tells us that we do that. Some alcoholics will do that. I think it's fearful that you're never going to drink again, and you just can't stand the idea. Because I always ask him if they've had enough. He told me he did, but evidently he still hasn't had enough. But I don't cut them off because they drink. I double my efforts. If they're interested, we continue on. His big argument is that, do we have to start all over again? You know, we haven't even gotten to step four yet. We just started step four, so it wasn't like we have this tremendous amount of area to go over. And I says, yes, Kelly, at least if anything else, we have to go over step one. We have to find out what went wrong and why and try to cut it off with the pit. We have to learn from that. You know, Harold, it's a stupid person who says that refuses to forgive at or forget. And it's the naive that forgive and forget. But it's a wise man who forgives but never forgets. We don't forget. We don't live in the past nor wish to close the door on it. So we want to learn from these behaviors and hopefully not repeat them. All right, we'll get started. Evidence of how much Alcoholics Anonymous struggle with its own powerlessness can be easily found in what we regularly refer to as the first step meetings. This occurs when a man or woman brand new to our fellowship is carted off into a private room after the opening announcements of a meeting with four or five of the old timers to be given their own special introduction into AA via the first of the 12 steps. In theory, this is a marvelous idea. After all, the purpose of the first step is to help the potential alcoholic decipher whether or not they have this illness. The problem is that the newcomer almost never comes out of the first step meeting with a clear understanding of the first step. Harold?
Yes, I let me interject at this point that we're going to make an attempt to announce when we're reading from the book, announce who we're quoting when we read a quote, and so that paragraph is right from the book. Excuse me. Is that correct? That one's from the book?
I didn't write this, so I don't know.
Oh, okay.
I believe it is not. I've come across this phenomenon before. I've gotten it on the website. Taking the newcomer into a meeting. I have it under the section on the website. It's called Meetings in Your Neck of the Woods. And I got this at a meeting about a year or two ago. Someone told me about it. I thought it was a great idea. When the newcomer came in, that especially in a newcomer's meeting, that a group who had previously volunteered, men with men and with four or five or so, would adjourn to a separate meeting location and have a meeting with the new guy to find out why he's there. Is this a nudge from the judge? Is he trying to keep a wife at bay, an employer at bay? Has he had an illness that has to be addressed? Was he just going down the road and he thought this was a place where they served alcohol? Whatever reason, at least we could talk about it. What happens is, the problem is, in my experience, and I'm sure yours too, Harold, is that people come in brand new. They never remember or hardly ever remember. You'll hear that 100 times, if not 1,000, what was said in their first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. By coalescing together, by grouping together and taking this man out, or this woman for women, have a personal experience about what AA, what they expect AA to do for them, and what it give them an overview of exactly what AA is to do. I'll go on. Generally, what will happen is that each of the old timers will tell a modulated version of their story, detailing all the mess and the damage and pain, and then conclude with something along the lines of, "And then I came to AA and it saved my life." So this man walks out of the meeting, and what does he know? Does he know what makes an alcoholic? Does he know if he qualifies as a real alcoholic? Does he know if the people telling the stories qualify as alcoholics? Does he have any idea what the next right action is other than keep coming back? It is really asking too much that just one of the old timers in that room might have a copy of the basic text of the organization and have the wherewithal to flip to page XXV1, which I still think is 26, and read the first and last paragraph on that page to this poor guy. People in the rooms will often refer to working step one. Step one is not to be worked. It is not a workable step. Our work will not start until step three. Step one and step two are information gathering steps only. In step one, we will gather the information needed to diagnose the problem, and in step two, we gather the information needed to define the solution. The steps are about bringing the solution to light. The 12 steps are often referred to as a program of action. But the program of action is actually located in steps 4 through 9. The first 3 steps prepare us for the program of action, and the last 3 are where we maintain at maintenance and grow. I like to think of it as the growth steps more than the maintenance steps, but and grow what we've gotten from the program of action. What's your impression of this information so far, Harold?
I think this is right on the mark. It really does define and clarify the fact that the action begins with step 4. That's where we get a paper and a pencil or a pen, and we begin the work. Step 1, I tell all of my sponsees that we do step 1 out there. We do step 1 out there. I tried to drink like other people. I tried to drink and only drink this or that, or switch to this or that, or only drink after 5, or only drink after noon, or I've tried everything. I tried to drink like a normal person, and we get to this point where we say, I just can't do this. I can't drink like other people. This has whipped me. I am whipped. That's step 1. I am whipped. And I don't do step 1 in the rooms. I don't do step 1 with a pen and paper. I do step 1 out there trying to control my drinking. That's my experience. That's what I talk to my sponsees about, and that works. Step 2 is a process of opening our awareness and coming to believe that there is a power greater than ourselves. That took some doing for me. I was not friendly with the idea that there is a power greater than me. The way my brothers and I were raised, we were told by my mother that, sort of like Muhammad Ali, you are the greatest, you can do anything you put your mind to, and there wasn't anything in there about a higher power, a power greater than me, and or the need for teamwork. Really, it was this self-reliant individualism and overconfidence that had really energized a lot of my problems, my disease of addiction. And so step 2 really is not a step of action. That's a step of awareness, of coming to believe, of developing some faith, or in my case, it was borrowing faith. I borrowed faith. I borrowed the faith of my sponsor, my first sponsor, and he said, here, you can use mine until you've developed your own, and that worked okay. So that was a matter of awareness and opening my eyes. And step 3, we make a decision. Step 4 is where the work really begins, the action. And this is a program of action and more action, but we do have to be ready for that. We have to get ready. And like my spiritual growth now, it's important for me to get my heart ready to receive Christ on a daily basis. And so we do steps 1, 2, and 3 on a daily basis. Well, at least steps 2 and 3, understanding my higher power. My higher power happens to be Christ Jesus. I'm a follower of Christ. It wasn't that way when I first began. So thank goodness for these steps. Thank God for these steps. Because and someone said it in the meeting tonight that we were at together, actually. They said, I came to I asked God to, let's see, how did it go? I asked God to bring me to AA, and then I asked,
I thank God for bringing me to AA, and then I thanked AA for bringing me to God.
Yes, that struck a tone with me. That was my experience. Joseph?
Thank you, Harold. Early on, before I continue, I wanted to explain, early on in AA, we had a thing called the surrender. It was done before you left the hospital. Most new alcoholics were gathered up from the from people new in AA. They knew to stay sober, they had to give it away, and they had to find someone to give it to. So they'd go to the hospitals, and they'd go to Skid Row, but hospital was a very fertile ground to find fledgling alcoholics. They're in the hospital because they're dying, or their disease has progressed to such a state that they're a little bit more willing when an introduction. So you would go in there and you would find somebody and you would talk to. Chapter 7 in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous talks about getting the confidence of another alcoholic. Only another alcoholic can accomplish that. Not a doctor, not a lawyer, not your wife, not your cousin Billy. Another alcoholic can gain the confidence of another alcoholic. No one else can. And then once you said you were willing, you had to do something called the surrender. The surrender was more than important. You've got to remember, at the time, there was only 6 steps from the Oxford group. It was a must. Bobby, who came into AA February 1937, recalled that after 5 or 6 days in the hospital, when you had indicated that you were serious, they told you to get down on your knees by the bed and say a prayer to God, admitting you were powerless over alcohol and your life was unmanageable. Furthermore, you had to state that you believed in a higher power who would return you to sanity. There you could see the beginnings of the 12 steps. He said, we call that the surrender. They, Dr. Bob, and the original AA members demanded it. You couldn't go to a meeting until you did it. If by accident you didn't make it to the hospital, you had to make it to the upstairs bedroom over at the Oxford Group AA meeting or at the Williams house. After the surrender, many of the steps involving inventory, admission of character defects, and making restitution were taken within a matter of days. In the first step, the task we are charged with is gaining a clear understanding of what alcoholism is, whether we or not we are suffering from it, and whether we are prepared to seek a solution. Remember, the problem is that we have no problem. We have no stinking problem. What we have is we have no stinking solution. Most alcoholics just entering AA, if asked how they know whether or not they're alcoholic, will generally point to data attending to their intake, specifically how much or how often they drink alcohol. Upon being told that these factors are not the key indicators in making a proper diagnosis, they will generally register confusion. We want to let them know that there are 2 specific conditions they need to be suffering from to qualify as the kind of alcoholic being described in the book. The first is these and found in page XXV1, which I still think is 26, and the 4th edition in the first full paragraph. We believe, and this is the big book now, we believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to the class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. And once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. Harold?
That's very, very important stuff. And it really takes a lot of courage for a person to look at their situation honestly and then to say, okay, and it's, and I love talking with people about their situation and about the fact that basically what I have is an allergy combined with a craving. And so that, you know, that doesn't go, that isn't the case with everyone, but it is with me. And that part of this whole process is so important to take a good, long, honest look at, so that we can properly diagnose, so that we can find the proper solution. So that's what we're getting at here, is that without the proper diagnosis, we really can't come up with the proper solution. And so that's what step one is all about. It's, I'm not big on labels, but I do, my experience is that we have to very carefully talk about our experience and be honest with ourselves about our experience, and that is how we move forward. This is all about movement. It's not about labels or belittling anyone. It's about movement. And until we can be honest with ourselves and with others, we simply are not going to move. And so the being in the counseling field, I often think about the fact that there is most of the time there's very little movement that occurs in people's lives. People don't change very much. One of the reasons I enjoy being in the drug counseling field is because in that area, more than any other, I think, in my opinion, people really do change. It's wonderful, and it's thrilling, and so that's what I love, especially about this type of counseling, and why I think I was called. I do think I was called. Joseph?
Thank you, Harold. The prospect may find that allergy is a curious word being used in relation to their drinking. When I'd go on dates, a date would ask me, how come you're not drinking? I'd say, well, I'm allergic. And usually they would just let it go at that. And some would say, well, how does that allergy manifest itself? I says, well, if I drink, I usually break out in handcuffs. We can let them know that the word refers simply to an abnormal reaction to something. An abnormal reaction to strawberries is generally hives. With peanuts, most people experience throat constriction. The abnormal restriction to alcohol is such that once an alcoholic takes a drink, they have no capacity to determine how many more drinks will follow the first one. It might be two. It might be 20. They can never be sure. This is abnormal. It is abnormal in that it's not supposed to happen. A normal drinker desiring a drink will experience an immediate internal sense of satisfaction upon their first sip. It may take a whole drink or a few for them to reach complete satisfaction. But the initial feeling of satisfaction will be immediate. When an alcoholic takes the first sip, their desire for alcohol will not be satisfied. It will be amplified. We are powerless over the first drink. I like this. I like to say, and I've heard in meetings many times, it's like getting hit by a train. It's not the caboose that kills you. It's that first drink of alcohol. The first drink gets you drunk, and a lot of people have a hard time with that. But it's only one drink. I tell my sponsees, anytime we take, as alcoholics, if we take a drink of alcohol, we've lit a fuse. Now, I don't know how long that fuse is. Now, that fuse could be days long. could be hours long. It could be weeks long. In some cases, it might be months long. Usually not. But once that fuse is lit, there'll be another drink and another drink and another drink. I always like the saying that goes, a man takes a drink, the drink takes a drink, and then the drink takes a man. Interestingly, what we have here is entirely manageable condition. If the alcoholic had nothing but the physical allergy, the problem would be almost comically simple to solve. Don't drink. In this regard, it's no different than any other allergy. Think of a man who develops an allergy to peanuts in his early 20s, and upon eating some peanuts one day, finds his throat closed to the size of a pinhole and nearly dies. Recovering in his hospital bed, the doctor enters to check on him, and the man says, "Doc, that was awful. I don't ever want to have that experience again. Is there anything you can recommend?" With the doctor's prescription, obviously, he'd confidently state, "Don't ever eat peanuts again." And what does the man do? He never eats peanuts again. This is what we call sanity. And this is why there is not a Peanuts Anonymous. Unless it's peanuts and, what was it, peanuts and Charles Schulz?
Oh, yeah, Linus.
Linus, Peanuts and not a Linus Anonymous. The difference, of course, is that the alcoholic has more than just a physical allergy. The allergy is compounded by another component detailed at the bottom of the page, XXIV, which I believe to be 24, but it's XXIV in the doctor's opinion. Men and women, this is the big book. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot, after time, differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented. Unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks which they see others taking with impunity. Harold?
Yes, that is so important to my program of recovery. I, on many occasions, will explain I have an allergy. I'm allergic to alcohol. I think on last week's program, I shared this story about passing by a bar at a resort in a tropical area. And as I walked by the bar, a man in there who was well on his way to being inebriated hollered, "Hey, buddy, come in, take a drink with us." And it was this man and the bartender, and I stopped and said, "Well, thank you very much for the offer." And I took a couple steps closer, and I said, "My situation is that I'm allergic to alcohol." And he said, "Allergic to alcohol? Oh, my God." He just was flabbergasted. And I could see the wheels turning as he imagined what in the world, you know, it would be the worst thing imaginable if you were allergic to alcohol. He was imagining not being able to drink and all sorts of things. So that's my normal reply when people ask me to imbibe with them. I'm allergic to alcohol, and it makes sense to people. It makes sense instantly. And then with people with a drinking problem, I can also add, and I, along with that, I have a craving for alcohol. I'm allergic to it, and I crave it. And that's quite a dilemma. It's a great conversation starter. And so that kind of, we're off on an interesting conversation, and it generally gets me off the hook. I don't you know, they don't expect me to drink after that conversation. And it really is true. That's my experience, as well as the kind of a scientific analysis of it. I'm allergic, and I crave it at the same time. Joseph?
Thank you, Harold. The writer Pascal said, all of reasoning ends in surrender to feeling. As the Big Book refers to it as utter defeat, bankruptcy, hopelessness, and hitting bottom. You know what the secret to life is, Harold?
What?
To replace one worry with another. Charlie Brown.
There you go.
Hitting bottom is relative to the individual. There are two alcoholics who are under a bridge. The one was lamenting his past life. A professional man with all the trappings, a beautiful wife, home, car, and position in the community, now reduced to living in a Lady Kenmore cardboard refrigerator box. The other alcoholic quips, wow, you got a box. We have learned whatever the bottom is, it takes what it takes. We had to fully concede, and that's what we're getting to. Fully concede, take ownership. Big Book says we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholic. This was the first step in recovery. Why must it be overwhelming, raw, and exhaustive? In the 12 and 12, it states, few people will sincerely try to practice the AA program unless they've hit bottom. Who wishes to be rigorously honest and tolerant? Who wants to confess their faults to another and make restitution for harm done? Who cares about a higher prayer? Who wants to sacrifice time and energy in trying to carry AA's message to the next sufferer? No, the average alcoholic, self-centered in the extreme, doesn't care for this prospect unless he has to do these things in order to stay alive himself. The pain and hitting bottom, that's what we get into action. Pain was the unwanted guest that came to dinner and moved into the guest house and in the end became our best friend. Harold?
Yes, the when we first arrive, we're willing to do work. We're willing to go to any length because of that pain. And then when after attending a while, the pain begins to diminish, and so does our willingness to do the work. So you've mentioned many times that part of being there, part of getting things done is working while we have that pain. That pain is actually our friend. And so that's, I'm well aware of that when I start working with somebody new in the program. We've got to work while we can, while that pain is still there. The pain is our friend. Joseph?
Yeah, I like to think of it not only as our friend, it's also fuel that we need to burn for this journey.
Yes.
My experience that once that pain is gone, and a lot of people had, you know, I came to that understanding on my own when I realized that when the old timers just say, sit down, put it in your mouth and listen. And I said, well, that's awful harsh. And I don't think they really knew what they were saying is you really can't talk to the solution. All you can talk to this problem, which is true. But I took it the next step as that pain was the motivation. Bill W. said, our co-founder said that he was beaten into a state of reasonableness. And I've said, you know, it's funny, I had said that for years and I didn't even know he had said that. And that reasonableness means he became teachable. As alcoholics, we're not very teachable people on our own. We can't really tell. You can tell an alcoholic anything. You just can't tell them much.
Yes.
Clearly, the reason that the man allergic to peanuts can easily stay away from the peanuts upon diagnosis of his condition is because this man will not find himself filled with restlessness, irritability, and discontent as a result of having no peanuts in his system. Conversely, the alcoholic, having sworn off alcohol, will eventually find himself so incapable of living inside his own skin that he will turn to the only thing he knows of which will quell the pain, a few drinks. Much like physical allergy, the mental obsession by itself is an entirely manageable condition. If a person finds that when they feel restless, irritable, and discontent, that a few drinks will take care of the problem, then there's no problem. Just take a few drinks. The illness of alcoholism lies in the fact that the fix for each of these conditions is the very thing that triggers the other, creating a deadly cycle, which history has proven unbreakable by the measures. And a full understanding of this fact is the key to our first step directions. Harold?
Yes, we need to be able to follow directions at least a little bit. So go ahead, Joseph.
All right, Al. Thank you. On page 30 in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, in the chapter called More About Alcoholism, we are given a clear window into the reason that many people, even after seeing clearly that they are suffering from both the allergy and the obsession, still have trouble making the admission of powerlessness. Sounds like Kelly right now. Kelly still can't figure it out. He still doesn't, even after all he's been through. When I went to pick him up, he literally walked into a tree and cut his face up. He was still pretty well in the wrapper. I said, how much did you have to drink? Do you know what his answer was?
What?
Two. Alcoholics.
But he was about 240s, right?
Alcohol. I chuckle to myself when I hear this stuff because I can relate to it. It's always two. How many did you drink there, son? Two, officer. Just two.
Yeah.
Hi, you got that lid on too? Yeah, must be that allergy shit. So. It's always two. I saw him today, and he looked like that meeting last night stuck him in a meeting and a half, and then he went to a meeting with Dale this morning, the 11 o'clock meeting at the club. And so I saw him after that. He's right at the corner of my subdivision. So every time I leave the subdivision, I run into him. And I thought that was a God deal, you know, where I could be that close to him. But, you know, it really doesn't matter on the sponsor. It really doesn't. You know, sometimes I like to think that helps, and it does help. But if the guy really doesn't want it, you can't really do anything right. And if he really does want it, you can hardly do anything wrong. The problem
That's
is spot. Go ahead.
True. And the line that really helped me a lot is the line in the Big Book that says, the idea that we could someday drink like other people has to be smashed. And that is so true. The idea that someday I can drink like other people, that idea has to be smashed.
Most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. This is the Big Book. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we can drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death, which is the gates of hell. Now, some do opt for death as a solution to alcoholism, some consciously and some unconsciously. But anytime we put a drug or a drink into our body, we're opting to die as an alcoholic or drug addict. We're trying to get away from the illusion of reality. We're going into a fantasy world, and we always have to be alone in that fantasy world. They are letting us know that while the idea of someday figuring out how to drink like regular people is perfectly normal, that you might consider getting over it quickly, as it is the very thought that puts most alcoholics in the ground. With that, we're given the task necessary to move to step two in the following paragraph. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we were like other people or presently may be has to be smashed. On the website, I have a, it's important for newcomers to get a Breaking Off the Romance of Alcohol for Dummies.
Yes.
And a Ronco Alcoholic Atom Smasher. It's a brick. And we have to break off. I tell my sponsees, it's like breaking off with a woman. The relationship.
Uh-oh. Did we lose the phone connection? I bet we did. Well, I can continue here and present the rest of the material and help us end the program in case I'm the only one left on the air. So let's see. And that paragraph is worth repeating. They are letting us know that while the idea of someday figuring out how to drink like regular people is perfectly normal, that you might consider getting over it quickly, as it is the very thought that puts most alcoholics in the ground. That thought kills people, that we can someday drink like other people. So with that, we are given the task necessary to move to step two in the following paragraph. We, quote, we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. That we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. The delusion that we were like other people, or presently may be like other people, has to be smashed. So that is step one, and as I said at the beginning of the program, I did step one out there, trying this and trying that and trying this and trying that. Finally, nothing works. I'm not like other people. I don't drink like other people. I won't be able to drink like other people, and I'm whipped. That's
Harold, we have a call. Can I take it?
Oh, yeah. Go ahead. Take the call.
Hello. You're on the air.
Hi. How you guys doing?
Good. Is this Peter?
No, this is Greg from Nashville, Tennessee.
Oh, okay. Nashville.
Greg.
That's cool.
Yeah, I stumbled on you guys. I'm kind of new to the platform, but it's interesting because I love the comments that you guys were making about, you know, hitting bottom. And you know, just running out of fuel, getting to the part where the pain is fuel. And it, just something crossed my mind that I never really thought about the Big Book is I really think it's a blueprint for the, how the human ego actually operates, and alcohol just happens to be part of that story.
That's interesting. Say more about that, Greg.
I've been sober 17 years this summer. If I make it to June, it'll be 17, and it's I was fortunate it was my mom's legacy. She got sober in 80, so I kind of grew up in the program. But I've learned a lot about really just the human ego in general, just life, because of AA. And it's something struck me when you guys were talking about that because, you know, I remember being out there and honestly thinking in my mind when I was still active in the addiction of, you know, I'm not down far enough yet. You know, I'm not sleeping in the bushes on a regular basis. You know, I've only slept in the park once. I've only woken up in the bushes once and thinking I needed to sink a little bit lower. And to me, that's the blueprint of the human ego. The human ego, like you said, some of us take it all the way to death. And that's really the ego's job is to keep me from seeing the truth and the reality of who I really am, even if it means the destruction of my own physical body. And to me, that it's just powerful that I think the Big Book, there's a lot hidden in there that the rest of the world benefits from because of people getting sober, but they just might not know it.
Well stated. That's very well put. And it is an overview of the human ego at work. And I define ego, E-G-O, as edging God out.
Yep.
So, yes, that's there's a part of me that wants to be self-reliant, that wants to have all the answers, that wants to stand on my own and be an island. That's the ego. And yes, I think all of society benefits from this small part of society that is learning to overcome that self-reliance and that lack of teamwork and to reach out, team up with other people in recovery and to team up with God.
Yeah.
I think the entire culture benefits from that. Well stated, Greg.
I can remember sitting in meetings when I was like 12 or 13. I wasn't in the program yet, but kind of at that age where I didn't really want to hang at the house alone, so I went to some meetings with my mom, but she died in 06, and the vast majority of the people at her funeral were from the program. So she sponsored so many people, but I'll always have a place in my heart for the program. I'm not active in it. I was able to, you know, get and stay sober in a different way, but it's always something. I mean, I still even today, you know, if you're new and you're listening to this, if you're a beginner, if you're going to meetings, you don't know what to do, this is for you. I'm sober almost 17 years. I still think about alcohol, but I don't have the obsession to drink anymore. It does enter my mind. I do think about it, but it's just a mental exercise. There isn't an actual craving or an obsession, and those are two completely different things, and I'll hang up with that.
You know, Greg, you know what the number one fear is? It's speaking in public.
Yeah.
And I came up with this, that it's more than the death of the body, the death of a child, the loss of a home, a loss of a wife, loss of a job. So at first blush, it doesn't look like much. So what's the big deal? What I realize is that the reason why speaking in public is the number one fear is because ridicule is death to the ego.
Yeah.
And the ego will sacrifice the body on the altar of pride in a vain attempt to stay alive.
Absolutely.
The preacher said, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. My ego would have killed me in a vain attempt to stay alive, to prove that it was right. You know,
yep.
As alcoholics might not ever be... we might not ever be wrong, but we might never be wrong, but we might never be right, but we're never wrong.
Yeah. You know, I live in Tennessee and you know, the Bible Belt, the buckle of the Bible Belt. So
right.
There's just a lot of humor in that whole thing. But one of the things I've always said down through the years, coming out of AA and it saving my life, because I did, you know, seven days a week meetings for the first couple of years, and I'm thankful for that. But I always tell people, you know, when you start talking about the spirit and the devil kicking you around, and there's a million ways you can express that, but I always said one thing. When I was in active addiction, the devil never kicked my door down and came busting in on me. I willingly right. opened the door. I called him. I welcomed him. I embraced him. I kissed him. I loved him like a brother. And there were days when, even when it was the darkest it had ever been and I didn't think I could get any worse, I actually embraced the thought of death. That's how strong the ego was, and it was, I can't think of any deeper form of insanity than that.
Yes, thank you. I'm sure anybody who's been in the program can, and people resist the program. You know, we hear oftentimes that we're in the program because we're saved by grace. And I like to think of this way, that I've gotten statistics that there's like between 14 and 18 million alcoholics, active alcoholics in the world. And according to the GSO, as of 2010, there's like 2 million in the rooms, counting cats both ways.
Yeah.
So what happened to the other 14 million? Did God didn't like them? They didn't get the grace? They didn't get grace? What happened? They were stepchildren?
Yeah.
I believe that we take a step towards God, and he takes a step towards us. We have to take an action. So I put it to you this way. We're saved by grace after all that we can do.
Yep.
Not after all that we can talk, not after all that we can think, and not even after all that we can pray. The magic words in the AA is action and more action. For faith without works is dead.
Yep. That if there's one thing, and I've said this from a public platform, because public speaking is a part of what I do in different ways. If AA taught me anything, it is that one of my biggest lessons that I had to learn, and the program helped me, is it doesn't matter what it is that I say. Show me what you can do. And I thought I could get by on just being a crafty wordsmith, you know. You know, I don't know too many drunks that don't like to run their mouths and talk about how brilliant they think they are.
You know, you're only going to hear that in the room.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, we're above average in our intelligence, but you're not going to hear that anywhere else but in the room. Say, hey, we're at
yeah.
a conference. You're not going to hear that in college. You know?
True, man.
You're going to say, oh, he's an alcoholic. So he's a lot smarter than the rest of us. You're not going to hear that. So I take it you found the love of Jesus, and that's what keeps you sober?
No, not really. I mean, I just happen to live in the South. I grew up out in San Diego area, but moved down here to be closer to family in 93 when I got out of the Navy down in Coronado. But it just happens to be the Bible Belt, and it's just funny because, you know, that's such a contrast to the West Coast. And it, you know, geography – everybody's the same wherever you go, if you really boil it all down. But it's, you know, when I moved out in 93 to Mississippi, I was pulling a geographic, you know, thinking it was going to be different. You know the story. But
sure.
I don't really have any particular brand of spirituality. You know, looked at some New Thought for a couple of years. I'm kind of a 1099 independent contractor when it comes to spirituality, kind of like my mom was, you know. Just okay with God and just learning as I move along, and, you know, don't have the corner market really on anything. But I'm thankful for the program because it saved my ass. And then I was headed for pushing up daisies, and there was just a little piece of me that knew that it could get better. But, you know, the bottom line is, because you said it, man, you said action. I didn't want to do what it took, man. I did not want to take the necessary steps to get sober. I knew what it was going to take because I had seen it, but I was just lazy.
I understand. I'm going to close up the show now. Thank you. I hope,
thank you.
You know, with 17 years with in the program, I hope you'd reconsider getting back into the rooms, not so much for you, but for what you can pass on to the new guy that's coming in. We've lost a tremendous amount of ground. I've done a lot of study on this, and, you know, the part of the Rum Radio, I do the rumradio.org website also. We're in 130 foreign countries, 2,007 cities,
wow.
Including Mississippi. We've had 119,000 hits to the website.
Cool.
I'm making a difference. There's no money being made,
yep.
And we're anonymous to the 11th tradition. So
if you
get back into the rooms, you're welcome. If you get back into the rooms, you got a lot to offer. There's a lot of lives out there that could use you.
Keep it rolling, brother. Keep it rolling.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming on. Thanks, Harold. We're just about ready. close it down. Remember, to go to rumradio.org. It's got a lot of good information. It's all programmed. The big book is all that we need. So have a good night. Do you have any last words, Harold?
No. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you, Greg, for joining us. And we'll see you on the radio.
Rumradio.org.